In 2007, independent musicians controlled about a quarter of the market, number two behind Universal Records. In 2013, that leapt to 34% and number one. Today, a look at the indie world through the eyes of Amanda Palmer. Now, she got a lot of flack for using Kickstarter to raise money for a new album and tour. She'd asked for $100,000. She got over $1 million. Critics wailed. She's married to a rich author, they said, Neil Gaiman. She asks musicians to join her on tour for free. She takes advantage of fans sleeping on their couches. Gawker called her a grifter. But as a new memoir makes clear, the Kickstarter campaign was just an extension of a relationship she's long had. Early on, she was a street performer, a human statue, exchanging flowers for donations. As half the punk duo Dresden Dolls, she had volunteer artists and buskers at every show. By the time she got and left a record label and became a solo artist, she was way ahead of the industry. In seeing the handwriting on the wall, it read, "Help." Her TED Talk was called The Art of Asking. Her new book has the same title. And Amanda Palmer, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Asking for help. I want to just listen to a song you wrote with your followers on Twitter. Just tell us a little bit about how the bed came about, which kind of says how you are now interacting.
The bed song. I had this idea about what a good artist looks like. When I'm writing, everything gets shut off because artists are supposed to need solitude. For this particular song, I just decided to do an experiment. And instead of putting my phone on airplane mode and shutting my computer and setting everybody and everything aside, I decided to just leave everything open. You know, I was turning towards the piano and then every 20 or 25 minutes checking in on Twitter and saying, "Hey, I'm writing a song. I'm going into my writing cave. I'm kind of taking you with me." You know, I posted a couple of photos of lots of crossed out words and sheets of paper strewn on the piano. And it felt wonderful. And this expands and extends to everything. You actually get to choose how you work, how you distribute your work.
Let's listen to the bed song.
Exhibit A, we are friends in a sleeping bag, splitting the heat. We have one filthy pillow to share.
Go back to a story that you tell in the book about when you were realizing that maybe the record label you finally got didn't get you. And this was just when the music industry was starting to change, and an executive was explaining to another executive, well, you know, Radiohead just put their record out and said that fans could pay what they wanted for it online. And what was the top executive's response?
Who is this Radiohead? I didn't know what to be more astonished at, the fact that he hadn't heard about In Rainbows, which Radiohead had dropped 2 or 3 weeks before. It was the biggest story to ever, you know, hit the music industry that year, or that he didn't actually know who the band Radiohead was. But the more important part of that story is all of these dudes were standing in the corner office just shaking their heads at each other in disgust, whereas my manager and I were jumping up and down going, no, this is it. This is going to be great. Everyone's going to help them. Watch, you'll see. This is going to be fantastic. And they just couldn't wrap their heads around it. Like, I was trying to pitch to them the idea that we should give things away for free on the internet. They were trading the music for free anyway, so why not just join them and meet them with gratitude instead of with hostility? And that's kind of what sunk the whole music business post-Napster.
Well, and as you write, I'm getting towards the end of your story, there are now artists who are using websites like Patreon.com,
yeah,
asking people to invest in their future CDs. You used Kickstarter. Some people are setting up their own websites. It's kind of like a direct deposit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it may not make you, you know, rich and famous, but it may be able to pay you a living wage if you even just have 400 or 500 people who are willing to support you because they love the work.
Yeah. But it's not just the executives that weren't getting it. You tell stories of other musicians, the lead singer of a big indie band. He talks about watching you, and you were in Seattle, I think.
Averting his eyes in shame.
Well, and he says, you stopped your set to ask your audience in Seattle to please text to their friends in Portland because your...
The show the next night wasn't sold out.
Right. He's appalled by this.
Well, appalled and also kind of jealous. A lot of musicians have said, well, you know, this is fine for you, Amanda, because you have this kind of relationship with your fans, and I'm not like that.
It's not cool.
It's not cool. I mean, the truth is, it isn't cool. I think my fans usually feel really grateful that I'm willing to make myself look uncool enough and be vulnerable enough to say, hey, I also need your help. And all of a sudden, like, the fourth wall collapses and they go, right now, like right here in the middle of the rock concert? And I'm like, yeah, right here in the middle of the rock concert. And a lot of that is what's been happening on the internet in general, which is just the curtain is just being ripped back on how these artists need to support themselves and how the machinery actually works.
But what about the question that, for instance, that musician had? What is the difference between begging and asking? What's the difference between giving someone a chance to feel useful during a concert when you have nothing to do but sit there and exploiting somebody by saying, hey, can I stay at your house even though I'm making money?
Right. The attitude with which you ask someone for something. If you aren't graciously willing to accept no easily, then you're not asking. You're demanding or you're begging.
I think you said if you ask with shame, like, I can't believe I need to ask someone this, then that's not going to work.
It kind of puts a burden on the person
you're
asking.
And you're going to feel shame. If you ask and demand, then it is a power trip because you know you have some control over them.
A lot of it is if you want to. Whoever wants to come over here. Yeah.
But there was this unbelievable backlash. You asked people to join you on stage and maybe play an instrument, and people thought that was the exploitive part. Lena Dunham ran up against the same thing on her book tour. She had people come and perform for free as an opening act. She decided to pay them. You decided to pay these volunteers something?
It was the easiest solution, for sure, and I think the same thing probably happened with Lena. If I'm not reading it wrong, both Lena and I were looking at it as an opportunity, almost as a gift.
Mm-hmm.
We have X amount of stage time. We want to be able to spread the spotlight. I don't think either of us thought for a second that what we were doing was like, ha, ah, like Mr. Burns, we're going to find these local people and take advantage of them. Like, it really was like, no, we want to share what we've got.
I live on Massachusetts Avenue.
Critics complain she's got a wealthy husband, writer Neil Gaiman, the irony being that she wouldn't accept money from him. More on that in a moment. Amanda, you say people want to help when asked that. And Kickstarter told you that over 887,000 backers of artists said they didn't want any gifts in return.
And I've talked to people at Indiegogo and at Patreon, and a lot of people really do come begging the artist to just let us help. We don't need a T-shirt. We don't need a poster. Just let me help you.
You also had a realization after the whole ruckus died down. What if instead of asking volunteers to come play for free, you had sold that opportunity to them?
Well, and in fact, right around the same time, and it slipped totally under the radar, the Polyphonic Spree actually did just that. Ran a Kickstarter around the same time I did, charged $1,500 for one of the packages, and you got to get on stage with the Polyphonic Spree and play an instrument. I think there's just a sense that as long as money is changing hands, everyone gets it and everyone's okay with it.
But what about the artist who really can't even come, as you say, come out of their garret?
Yeah.
You know, what happens to the J.D. Salingers of the world?
Yeah, I call it the P.J. Harvey question. It's what's happened throughout history with any artist who was totally introverted and in the garret. The artist had an advocate.
A patron.
A connector. And that isn't going to change. You know, Bach wrote for the church. All of a sudden it was Capitol Records and your song had to be 3 minutes to fit on a vinyl side. I think we could be heading into a dangerous ecosystem where the loudest artists and the most social artists win. That would be a loss for everybody because some of the most potent artistic voices are the quieter ones.
It was something that Taylor Swift said she was worried about when she pulled her catalog off Spotify. She had a friend who was a wonderful actress, but was told she didn't get hired for a job because there was another actress that had a bigger Twitter following.
Sure. If I were being totally Machiavellian about it, I would look at the number of tweets and the amount of engagement. Because someone might have a million Twitter followers but have tweeted 7 times and actually not have a relationship with those million people.
Aren't you also concerned that that really good actress doesn't get hired because she's not into Twitter?
Well, and am I concerned that the other actress who's blonde and 6 feet tall is going to get the part over the chick who's 4 feet tall? Like, yeah, it's totally. The decks are stacked every possible which way. And I always hope and harbor hope that touching voices, creative voices, will somehow seep their way through the misery of the industry and the system.
Well, that engagement on social media with fans can be fraught. You wrote a poem about the surviving suspected Boston bomber. It enraged some people. They thought they saw sympathy in it. You invited Jean Gomeshi, the Canadian talk show host, to appear with you in Toronto. He's been accused of abusing women under the guise of consensual sex. You initially stuck with that invitation. But on the other hand, how much did your fan base help you there? You changed your mind.
I did change my mind. We don't always agree with each other. And I invited him months ago to be one of the tour guests, along with Peter Sagal and Armistead Maupin and Amy Cuddy and Neil Gaiman and all these other people. And when the news first hit, my first reaction was, like, I wouldn't kick out a dinner guest if someone, you know, was whispering behind their back. I just stood up and said, this is how we run things here. We don't uninvite our guests. And the fan base was like, maybe we should think about this. And then over the next 48 hours, the story exploded. And
your fans encouraged you to reconsider.
Yeah, they did. And I listened to them. I took a few days, took a deep breath and said, okay, the obvious thing to do here is, you know, is to find a new guest. And thank you, everyone, for waiting. But at the end of the day, it feels like I'm at a family dinner table having a healthy, loving discussion or argument with people who I know I'm going to still love when I get up and go to bed. It feels like a really real kind of love.
Well, you do have real family and real friends. I just want to mention the book also is about your relationship with your mentor, Anthony Martinetti, a psychologist, neighbor since you were a child. You talk about his battle with cancer. Your fans embraced him. And this is also a story of your marriage to Neil Gaiman. There are delightful tidbits, including that he has an app so that he can know when you have PMS. Who knew? But here's where you dive into the question, why is it easier to have this relationship with these strangers who are fans than it is at times with your husband?
Right. It's a lot easier sometimes to be intimate with strangers. It can be much harder to have to stay the course in an actual relationship, and you can't turn it on and off like a phone. And we've actually learned really valuable lessons over the years about how to not drag our personal relationship into the social media realm where we really could and have hurt each other. And it is truly a bizarre modern love story of how Twitter has affected our relationship, how our relationship has affected our Twitter feeds. The biggest challenge was when I wrote the TED Talk, I immediately saw how everything else connected too. And sure, there was the music industry and street performing and stuff. But I also felt the deep hypocrisy of my ability to stand on the TED stage and preach The Art of Asking while I literally simultaneously was locked in this battle with myself to take help financially from my husband because my best friend was sick with cancer and I had to cancel a tour. And it was either somehow stand up and deal with it or keep running away. And the poetry was deafening, honestly, because I could take all of this help from strangers. But when it came to my husband, I was finding it really difficult. And I knew that paradox was going to, and Anthony's illness, which continues to this day and has sort of created a bizarre triangle in my life with me and him and Neil, was going to be the spine of the book because it wasn't just me that had a hard time asking. It was Neil for certain things and it was Anthony for certain things. And then I just looked out at the concentric circles of my life and the world and thought, I'm not alone here. It's everybody.
The book that came from that realization is called The Art of Asking, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Let People Help, by Amanda Palmer. Amanda, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And for more on the book tour, including her stop at the Royal Theater in Boston tonight, go to hereandnow.org. You're listening to Here and Now.